Over the decades, the issues have changed. In the 1960s, it was contraception. Later, it was premarital sex, divorce, homosexuality. But one constant in the modern history of the Catholic Church in this country has been the thoughtful, articulate dissent from church doctrine by Father Charles Curran, now professor of human values at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. I'm very pleased to welcome Charles Curran to State of Belief Radio. Charlie, thank you so much for being with us today.
Well, Elton, it's my pleasure to be with you.
How important is church history in the arguments that you've made over these decades?
Well, that I think you're in the wrong vocation. You should be a Catholic theologian. Because right here you are exactly pointing into the primary issue. And the primary issue is precisely that of historicity, historical development, and historical consciousness. And the danger in Catholic thinking was that there were things that were always and everywhere the same. That in fact the old Catholic hymns and prayers always ended per omnia saecula saeculorum, through all the centuries until the end. Well, that this historical change is so different. And in fact, one of my teacher, Father Bernard Lonergan, when he was asked, what took place in Vatican II? Why did Vatican II change so much in the Catholic Church? And his answer was precisely yours. He said, historical consciousness. And historical consciousness is distinguished from what he called classicism. Classicism believes in the eternal, the immutable, and the unchanging. I'm looking out the window here at my institution over you, and every one of our buildings is built in the classical architectural form. We've got those Ionic, Doric, and Corinthian columns that go way up. They're solid. They're permanent. They're not going to change. Huh? That was Greek architecture. Mm-hmm. But look at contemporary architecture. You know, I mean, the buildings are no longer square. They're all over the place. Huh? I mean, that's just a quick illustration here, that this historical consciousness says that change and development takes place, and that we have to recognize that and deal with it. Mm-hmm. And that was really what my professor Bernard Lonergan said way back in the 60s, that it's that historical development has always occurred within the church. Mm-hmm. In fact, again, learning from Lonergan, I used to say when I first taught in the seminary, you know, St. Peter would have flunked a first grade catechism exam. You'd ask him, how many persons are there in the Trinity? He'd say, what are you talking about? What is a person? What's a Trinity? Those were all concepts that the church learned in the 4th and 5th centuries. Yeah. You know, it's amazing how much development has occurred in the Catholic Church. Huh? But the problem was that, especially from the Reformation on, the Catholic Church was defensive. Its understanding of the church was triumphal. We never change. We have the truth, and we're not going to change one bit. Well, that's not true. That's not what the Catholic Church has been over the centuries. Yeah. Yeah. And as I say, once you have a sense of history, mm-hmm. you realize how much change has occurred, mm-hmm. and why it's absolutely necessary that change must continue to occur. Mm-hmm. Now, again, that doesn't mean that any change goes kinds of things, huh? But it does mean that, especially, I mean, as I said before, we've always got to you know, believe that God is love. Mm-hmm. But when you get down to it, well, what does love mean? And interestingly enough, even within the New Testament itself, there are various understandings of love. That, for example, the Synoptic Gospels say the great example of love is love of people in need, love of the poor, love of enemies. Yeah. That's what you have to do. But what does John's Gospel say? Love one another as I have loved you. Mm-hmm. As the Father loves me, and I love the Father, so you people in the church must love one another. It's the love of the sisters and brothers. But that's because he was dealing with a particular problem in the early church where the church people were fighting one another. So to get them to avoid that, John's Gospel says, love one another. Let's get rid of all these divisions and stuff in the church kind of thing.
Yeah.
I mean, these differences have always been existing, in other words.
You gave us an insight into the conflict at Catholic University of America in Washington, D.C., related to contraception. You spent 2 decades there, so I know that was a place of home. Were you known as the relentless critic, or would that be an exaggeration?
I think an exaggeration, because I mean I was a. In fact, when I left, or when I was thrown out, you might say, of Catholic University, my faculty colleagues took me out to dinner, and we had a nice celebration. And they said, well, how do you feel? And I said, this is tough for me. I mean, I found here a home. I found people who shared thoughts with me. I just hope I can find that same thing wherever I go in the future. But I'm going to miss this, and miss it very much, despite the problems. Mm-hmm. And that, I think, goes back again to that distinction I made, or I didn't make, but that the Catholic Church has made, between those teachings that are core and central to the church and those that are further peripheral and removed. Mm-hmm. And I have not challenged that. I believe that Jesus is God. I have not challenged it. I mean, that means quite a bit to me. I mean, I still, I wish my prayer life was better than it is, but I still try to work on it.
Mm-hmm. What were your greatest sources of satisfaction from your time at Catholic University?
I think the greatest source was the positive reception from colleagues and students. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, to this day, I still have people call me or write me and say, I appreciate so much what you taught me, et cetera, how you opened my eyes, how you got me to see there was a different way of looking at things. And maybe that's the great joy of anybody who's a teacher.
Yeah.
It's your students, and that you feel that you've done something, and especially your students and your colleagues. I mean, that there's, in fact, this is interesting. The other day in my course here, the undergraduates of this Methodist institution, that I reminded them that in our library, we had a magnificent library here, and we have a 1577 volume from Bishop Antoninus of Florence, and where he talks about the obligations of various states of life. But he says the first obligation of physicians is to be competent. And as I say, to me, and he said, the best judge of competency is, in fact, he here's this guy, I love him. He's a little small guy. And he said, well, some people say, You're competent if you've graduated from a university. And I say to my students, what do you see in every doctor's office? Degrees, right? They're plastered all over the place. Now, also, though, they never tell you what the grades were, but at least they tell you they graduated. Huh? Yeah. But Antoninus's point was marvelous. He said, look, I've spent my life in universities. I've taught there, I've studied there, and I know there are a lot of people in universities who aren't competent. Hmm. The best judgment of competency is judgment by peers. And that's what my peers have done for me, frankly, huh? It's that judgment that has made me feel that, yes, I have done what I should have done, and I've been supported in it.
After so many years at Catholic University, what happened in 1986?
Well, part of the Catholic Church's reality and problem is it's living in the past. And it took that long to finally get me from 1968 to 1986. Huh? And the Pope said I was not suitable to be a Catholic theologian. And then there was some battles going on within the Catholic University about it. But the and I took them to court when they said I lost my tenure. I said, you can't take it away from me. Well, in the end, the District Court of Columbia said no. There was nothing in my contract or any other faculty member's contract at Catholic University that would demand that if the Vatican said someone was no longer a Catholic theologian, that there was nothing in my contract that said that the university could not accept that judgment. That was the case.
Ah. Well, and that had repercussions all through academia, didn't it?
Yes, it did. Yes, it did. And I mean, again, the whole role of Catholic universities and what is the role of Catholic universities? And I have been a strong supporter of the need for academic freedom in Catholic higher education. And again, academic freedom says, that you have to, that the faculty member has to be free to express positions on subjects, et cetera. But again, the professor, she has to be competent. Mm-hmm. And again, competency is determined by judgment by peers, not by outside people, but by your peers. Yeah. And but this only came into Catholic university life in this country, frankly, in 1960. It began in 66, 7, and 8, actually. I mean, this was a strong, very recent development that, comparatively speaking. But, I mean, it was where that Catholic higher education accepted the norms and principles of the American higher education and what is called the American Association of University Professors.
The Vatican still challenges your right to teach Catholic theology. That just blows my mind. Charlie, what is the very real damage done to Catholic theology by silencing dissent or discussion? What does the church lose, and what do the faithful lose?
I think, that it's a terrible loss, but very bad loss. But the reality is there are many people, I'm no longer the voice in the wilderness. As I said before, even in the beginning in 1968, I had over 600 Catholic theologians in this country agreeing with me kind of thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've never been the lone wolf. I've never been the voice in the wilderness. That my position, it might not be, you know, accepted by the Catholic in the pew kind of thing, but by Catholic theologians, it's a well-known teaching.
Yeah.
In fact, just a little story. I was in the midst of that 1968 thing. I was walking in Washington and ran into a bishop whom I knew, and I said to him, "Well, I suppose you're not very happy with what I'm doing." And he said, "No, Charlie." He said, "I taught in the seminary. I know the difference between infallible and non-infallible teaching. You're not saying anything different." Now, you know, not all the bishops, you know, would agree with him, but yeah. I mean, I was sort of amazed when he said, "No, it doesn't bother me at all."
Yeah. What are the voices that you most worry about being silenced today, both within and beyond the church?
Well, quite frankly, that I don't think that anybody is going to be silenced by church authority anymore. I mean, let's face it, there were very few cases after mine. There were a few, but no one ever had as severe a penalty as I had, kind of thing. Hans Kuhn and myself, but nobody else. And I think now, I mean, people realize that's just not going to happen anymore. And it hasn't happened. And so I think that's to the good. Now, on the other hand, you know, there is the quiet side. I mean, I'm never invited to take part in any, you know, official Catholic groups. I used to go, you know, there were bishops' commissions I would serve. I don't have any official role like that. Mm-hmm. But but on the other hand, you know, I probably have a much more important role mm-hmm. to play in the total people of God.
Yeah.
There was a cartoon in, I forget where it appeared. I don't think it was the Times, but it was right after 1968. And the Pope is saying, "Whatever happened to that American Catholic theologian that I silenced?" And then there's a picture of me with 20 microphones in front of me, kind of thing. I mean, in the end, you know, their action probably went against them. You know,
yeah.
I mean, that's the ironies of life. Let's sure. say. Huh?
Do you worry that powerful conservative forces in the church are aligned against Pope Francis, the same forces that used to always say dissent was heresy?
I am very worried about that. And frankly, I think that the Pope himself is worried about it. Now, I have written that, and I don't think Pope Francis is ever going to change one of these teachings that I disagree with. Mm-hmm. But he has invoked what again is a traditional old principle, and it came up very well when he was talking about gay relationships. And they coming back from one of his trips on a plane, they asked him about it. Gay relationships, and he said, "Who am I to judge?" Mm-hmm. That we've always said that the internal disposition of the heart is where sin resides, not in the external act itself.
Yeah.
So he's not going to go as far as I want him to go, but he's going to move, you know?
Yeah.
And that's why some of the conservative voices in the church are not happy with what he's doing.
Sure.
I mean, the poor Pope. I mean, that's a terrible role to play.
Yeah.
And this cartoons, you know, humor is important. Yeah. I always say that the two great signs of transcendence that get you out of the present are prayer and humor.
Yeah. Right.
And mm-hmm. right after the reaction to the encyclical of 68 and our reaction against it, There was a cartoon in the New Yorker, and it had three people in a room. I don't know, De Gaulle was one of them, the president or the prime minister of England and the president of the United States, and they're talking about their problems. And there's a knock on the door, and it's Pope Paul VI. And they say, oh, welcome to the club. You know, that's why I say humor and prayer are the great signs of transcendence.
Charlie, as you look back across your career, is there one regret that stands out for you? Is there something you wish you had done or wish you had not done with the benefit of hindsight?
Yes, but I think, you know, in a sense, sure. Well, you know, I mean, I could have taught this course better. I could have I could have responded better to your questions today than I have. Huh? I mean, in one sense, the perfect is the enemy of the good. Mm-hmm. And none of us is perfect. We've all made all sorts of mistakes. But I must say, in terms of the general things that I have done, I'm in good conscience. I've satisfied myself that I think I did what I should have done. Mm. And we've always said, interestingly enough, in the Catholic Church, the sign of a good conscience is the peace of conscience.
Yeah.
And, you know, what else could you ask for?
What would you say to someone contemplating loyal dissent in the structures they find themselves in? Why risk career, opportunity, reputation?
Well, first of all, because in my ethics, I'm opposed to what they call consequentialism, that says that the only thing that counts in making a judgment is what are the consequences of the act. I think you got to do what you think is right, no matter what the consequences are. And I mean, I think that's what I tried to do. I mean, today, there are many people who dissent to the church today. I mean, look at all the divisions. In fact, yesterday, I had a conversation with the president of our university, and something came up about the problems, you know, within the university. And he looked at me and he said, well, look at Charlie. I mean, the problems of the Catholic Church are much bigger than the problems within our university.
After all these years, why are you still a Catholic? And why are you a Catholic priest?
Okay. First of all, it's because everything I have said, I am convinced of the Catholic Church as being a true, with all its problems, that is an important way. I'll put it this way: not the only way, but an important way in which God works in this world, and that I have been the benefit of that. I mean that you know, to me, it's an important thing to recognize that there is a Redeemer in this world, that people can have hope. I mean, look at what's going on in the world. Look at what's going on in the churches. But I mean, there's so many problems. There's so much difficulty, and I'm afraid even with our young people, they're losing hope. And I agreed so much with St. Paul. You know, if you see it in front of you, it ain't hope. I mean, hope, you know, as the scripture says at times, it's like the farmer that puts the seed in the ground and it's growing there, but you never see it till the end. Yeah. And that hope, I think, is the most important Christian virtue there is. And we all need hope in the situations in which we live, the situations of our churches, our world, etc. So it seems to me then that if I had to stress anything, that it's the church that has always taught me the vital importance of hope, and that this is a promise of God that ultimately God's love will overcome all obstacles. My sinfulness, my crazy things, my mistakes, but also the broader mistakes of the world, the suffering, the whole evil that's going on in the world. I mean, that's the one of the great benefits, that we are people who can have hope. That doesn't mean we don't get discouraged. That doesn't mean we don't have bad days. But it does mean that there's something that we can't see that we believe is at work.
Father Charles Curran is professor of human values at Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas. He tells his story in the powerful memoir, Loyal Dissent, Memoirs of a Catholic Theologian. Charlie, I firmly believe that the hope for our future as a species, as a culture, and as people of various religious and non-religious orientations lies in the hands of loyal, loving, faithful, courageous dissenters. I often think, where in the world would we be right now in progressive religion if we had not had dissenters that helped open our eyes? The status quo is not working. It's been an honor to visit with you today. I thank you for all you've done to lead and to challenge, and I thank you so much for being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Well, I appreciate this hour. It was a great honor for me to be a part of it. I apologize for this terrible cold I have right now, but I enjoyed it very much, and thank you for giving me this opportunity.
You can view the entire conversation on our website at stateofbelief.com.